Hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of Lunch Therapy. I'm your host, unlicensed lunch therapist, Adam Roberts. You're probably wondering where I've been for the past 2 months. Well, on August 14th, we moved to New York City, specifically Brooklyn, where we now reside on the edge of Carroll Gardens and Borham Hill, and we are loving it. We're so settled in now, and I'm ready to kick the podcast up again. Is that an expression? I'm not sure. And this episode is one I recorded right before we left, so this is a couple months old, but it's still a great conversation, and I'm excited for you to hear it. My patient today is Abby Balanjit, the blogger behind The Dusky Kitchen and the author of the brand new Filipino-American dessert cookbook, Mayumu. In today's episode, we talk all about dressing appropriately for the podcast.
Since, like, I'm wearing like a Frasier shirt, I'm like, this feels so Frasierian.
Taking her parents' food for granted growing up.
And I took it for granted, like adobo we talked about earlier. Like my parents, that was like their lazy, like, I have to get this done really fast kind of meal. And I was always like, adobo again.
And figuring out what she wants to do next.
Who wrote a book, and it's like, that weight of that is kind of huge. And I think that's so hard to bounce back to, like, day to day.
So without further ado, here is my lunch therapy session with Abby Balanjit.
Well, Abby, thank you so much for doing lunch therapy. I have been like tearing through your cookbook this morning. It is beautiful. Congratulations. How does it feel to have it out in the world?
Oh, thank you, Adam. I mean, it's really exciting. I think it's always like kind of surreal seeing it in people's homes. Like today I saw like someone's cat like lying on top of it. Like a stranger, I don't even know, their precious cat. And I was just like, this is like so surreal. Like, I think, again, it's like, it's proof that kind of books live on kind of forever in a way that I love to blog and I love to be on the internet, but it's just so different. It's just so tangible and physical.
It's so funny you said that, because that just brought back a memory of when my cookbook came out, somebody sent me a picture of their dog, like, tore my cookbook to shreds. And they had a picture of their dog with like my shredded cookbook. So yours sounds much more like positive. But it was so funny because I saw Mark Bittman did an Instagram post about you. And so I've quick clicked through and we got in touch. And when you sent me this book, it's just like jaw-droppingly gorgeous. Like, it's just, if I didn't know you or if I hadn't invited you on this podcast, I would have grabbed it off the shelf. I mean, can you talk about like the process of making it? Because it looks so cool on the fonts and the colors and everything. What was it like?
Well, thank you. I mean, that's such a like a collaborative effort too with my food stylist, Katie Wayne, my photographer is Nico Shinko, and my prop stylist is Maeve Sheridan. And so like having all these people on board like really helped execute things that I did on like my like really shitty like iPhone camera quality. Like, it's fine. And then, like, you know, you do it at home and you just do it to, you know, at least you take food pics and you're like, okay, this is what ideally you want it to look like. But I guess having like that kind of like lighting and I think everyone's expertise, it was just like much even like 10 times better than I could have even imagined. And so the whole cookbook shoot happened May of last year. Okay. So 2022, and it was a 6-day shoot. So we had 60 recipes to shoot. So averaging like 10 a day. And you know, I think it was my first time ever doing like a food shoot, honestly. And it's kind of surreal doing like a 6-day shoot and never have done like, even one. And yeah. And after the fact I did. And so it's kind of like weird to do things kind of in reverse sometimes, it feels like, in terms of just like experience. Mm-hmm. But it was so much of just like, you know, like for me being on set and also like I'd bake some of the things too, but I think Katie, she's literally, I remember on her bio was like, I'm a hand model. And I'm like, oh, that's cute that you were saying that. She's literally a hand model. I was like,
really?
Oh my God. I didn't know that you were so talented in so many things. And, you know, she and Nico had worked on Snackable Bakes by Jesse Sheehan.
Of course, alumni, yeah, of this podcast. She's been on here before.
I love her. And so, yeah, it was kind of like so ideal to have people who have worked together before too, because they already have a working rapport. And so it was just really seamless to kind of be like, this is my specific vision, not exactly like Jesse's. And that's perfect, because like, you don't want people to have like the same type of cookbook.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I think what I like so much about what you guys did is the way that like the Filipino ingredients, like ube, is that how you say that? Ube?
Yes.
Like the color, like that, the picture of like the ube, like in the mason jar, it's like bold, like eye-grabbing purples, and it's just like so wonderful because it's not fake. It's not like you're like pretending this is something that you cook with. It's like, no, this is a real ingredient, but yet it's also like eye-catching and beautiful to look at. So anyway, I'm gonna stop praising you now, but you should feel very good. Well, I was also going through the recipes. I mean, I am not even sure which one I'm gonna make first, but there's so many cool twists. Can you talk a little bit about like the Filipino American sensibilities coming together, like in the adobo chocolate chip cookies or the MSG brownies. I mean, there's so many cool twists on classic American desserts. So where do you start with all that?
You know, it's interesting that, like, I think that being Filipino American, I feel like sometimes like a translator and like a mediator between both parts of my like identity. And a lot of my influence comes from my parents and what I ate as a kid. But also it's, you know, it was hard for me to be like, you know, like there's certain things that even I have never attempted to try to make that are traditionally Filipino, because it's like you go to a bakery and you get done, or my mom will make it and that's fine. And so I think my base understanding of baking and desserts was honestly first formulated by like watching Food Network, watch like
Yes.
baking vlogs. I love
You're a
spending
lot younger than me, because I read your introduction where you talked about watching the Food Network. And when I watched the Food Network, I would watch it like back in the like early 2000s, late 1990s, when it was like Sarah Moulton, who I don't even know if you know who that is, but it was like Mario Batali before he got, you know, canceled or whatever.
Yeah.
But like those were the original Food Network stars, and I would watch. But you were watching like Unwrapped.
Yes.
What else were you watching on the
Ace
Food
of
Network?
Cakes. I was so and Food Network Challenge, when it was literally only cake challenge. I think it is similarly. I feel like they always have a lot of cake challenges still to this day.
Yes.
But I don't know. It was a different era, because now that I think about it, like the trends for cakes are much more just like all buttercream, literally to no evidence of fondant most of the time. And so
Yes.
it's like such a different style of like baking and desserts that, you know, I feel like so old school. I mean, like I love, like when I was younger, I was like, oh, macarons are like the pinnacle of desserts. And
Yes,
then
I
just
remember
learn
that.
how to make them. And, you know, I still think they're delicious and everything, but the way that kind of, I guess, initial knowledge of like baking, or what I thought was baking, kind of like influenced a lot of the book, of like tying in like very Western American influences, at least sometimes in the form. It was just like a cupcake, you know, a straight up like muffin or something, but actually incorporating like Filipino ingredients, and then vice versa of also having like Filipino traditional rice cakes called kakanin, but also infusing kind of American style like flavors and techniques. So it's
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because you
fun.
have like that strawberry shortcake, like rice cake, that is sort of like more, I guess, more of a Filipino dessert, but you're bringing in the strawberry shortcake flavors. But then on the flip side, you have like the chocolate chip cookie, which you're bringing adobo into, which, by the way, I mean, when I was reading about it, and I guess the New York Times, Genevieve Coe adapted your recipe. And so, and I really liked what she was saying about how these flavors sort of enhance the chocolate chip cookie, like make it even more of like, you know, an enjoyable experience. But like, it's probably like an interesting thing as a baker who's trying to do something original, but you probably don't want to do it just for the sake of being original. So like, were there any struggles like where you were like, let's do like something where like it totally didn't work at all, or you were, you know, trying to combine the two, or did it always work?
You know, I think it was a lot of trial and error with that too. And I think a lot of it is like, I love savory and salty flavors in my desserts. And so I think it was always kind of like, is this
Yes.
too much? Or,
Yeah.
and I think on the flip side of that too was like, am I just doing this to put this in? Does it even add value or, you know, flavor to it? And I like came across that kind of not issue, but more so like quandary of like, okay, like for the Torrones de Cassoy MSG brownies, like, is this enough MSG? And what is it supposed to like do? Because are you supposed to even taste the MSG like that? And for me in that recipe, it's like so much more of like an enhancer of flavor, because there's five spice in the candy that's on top of it. And so it's so much of like, you know, like it's very much finding the balance. And it's easier said than done a lot of the times. And so I'm really grateful that it, at least in the process, I learned a lot about like what I can. Well, I think the sky's the limit of what you can do, but it's also like someone is there to kind of like rein you in, at least in your ideas, to make sure they make sense, with which is what's great about having an editor and everything and all these like people like in your book process.
Got it. Well, I mean, the adobo chocolate chip cookies, I thought it was so interesting that it has bay leaves in it. Is that right? And then it has like soy sauce in it. And it's like, I have that thing in my brain now, like it's sort of like reading music, where like when I read a recipe, I try to like imagine what it like sounds like or tastes like. And so I was just like, I haven't made them yet, because I just got the book, but like I'm just fascinated at that idea of like a bay leaf flavor and a soy sauce flavor in a chocolate chip cookie. That just sounds so good and interesting. So
Oh,
I'm
thank
excited.
you, Adam.
Well, now it's time for your therapy session. So now we're going to get into the nitty gritty. So Abby, what did you have for lunch today?
Okay, so right now, currently, I'm in my boyfriend's apartment. I live with my roommates in a whole nother neighborhood in Brooklyn. So he's in
Okay.
Greenpoint. I'm currently in Greenpoint. He is not here. He is working. I'm also
Okay.
technically working, but he went to a conference. And so I've like scavenged his fridge, not necessarily like my home base. And so he had pre-made like already like taco meat. So it's just like ground beef, cumin, some like smoked paprika, I think he put in there. And then I got like corn tortillas. I put them on the stove to kind of like toast them each on each
Love
side.
that. Yeah.
And I did, he loves to make salsa lately. So this is his like homemade salsa era. And I put some of that on it and cilantro. And then specifically I had, do you know the pepper plant hot sauce sauces?
It sounds familiar, but I don't know. No, I don't really know
It's
it.
very, what's it
Sorry.
called? So specific to a certain part of California that is, it's not necessarily LA, but I was in the Monterey Carmel area, and it's
Okay.
kind of like this, it's like a really delicious, like a little bit salty, just like a nice like pepper sauce, chunky garlic sauce, that's only specifically in, I guess, Gilroy or whatever, somewhere in there.
Oh yeah, but that's where they have the garlic festival every year.
Yes. So it's really good on top of tacos, so I had that. And then I also scavenged for more things because I love something sweet at the end of any kind of meal. And he doesn't really have a lot of dessert, unfortunately. So I got like these Tom Cord seedless grapes that he had. And I just ate fistfuls of them. And so now we're here. And honestly, Adam, thank you for reminding me to eat lunch because sometimes it's really, I was like, I have to eat lunch. I have to eat lunch. It was like the only thing Adam made wanted me to do. But I was like, oh my God, like I truly forget a lot, unfortunately, a lot of the time. So I
Which would have
really.
been, that actually would have been okay. I should have said, I sometimes say, just eat whatever you would normally eat, even if that means not eating. So I should have said that,
No,
but.
but it's good to, I feel like it's good to eat. I think it's like one of those things. I technically work a lot of the times from home remotely. And it's like, I think it's easier to find that separation when you're in an office sometimes where you're like, okay, times of taking out a, take my little walk and go outside. But there's something about being at home where it's just like, it's, there's just like no interruption to your daily life. It's like, okay, well you should eat unless someone else is literally telling you in your ear, eat. So thank you for being that voice in my ear of
See,
reason.
like I don't relate to that at all. Like I grew up in a Jewish family where like every meal was like calculated down to the second. And so like I do not relate to, I have so many friends who are like, even my husband, like he's like, I forgot to eat lunch. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like every moment of every day, I'm like, what is my next meal? So I admire it, but I don't relate to it. But in terms of your therapy session, I'm already picking up on like a spontaneity factor, like that you're very good at like sort of taking what's available and like grabbing it and like making do with it. And so is that sort of how you've always been, or are you more of like a planner?
Oh, I do think that, in my best, sometimes I do want to be the planner. Like a lot of times I'm like, if in my best, in my own home, if I'm like literally in my element, I'll be like, I'm going to go to the grocery store and get every single ingredient on this recipe list. And I think my boyfriend is on the spontaneous side. I love Jason. I think he brings out a part of me that's like very good to be in the moment, and be like, okay, we have this at hand. What can we do with it? In a very Chopped style, I guess, speaking back to
Yes, which
your
is really fun
Which
sometimes to
is
get to do
fun.
that.
And it's weird to think that, like, I do think that in at least with baking and desserts and stuff, and when I'm in that zone, I think there is levels of spontaneity, at least with like, oh, flavor wise, like in the moment, this sounds really good. But I do think I'm pretty meticulous when it comes to like, I think it's that breaking brain where it's like, I need every single ingredient on this list, or I feel like it won't go well. And I think I'm just like very stressed type A personality about that. And
That's
I
so
do want to do
interesting.
better. Yeah, like improv, I want to do better. But I think in my head, like I think that I know like flavor-wise what I want, but it's more of just like execution. I want all the things, all the tools in my toolbox, if that makes sense.
Well, it's funny, like the idea of like whimsy and expertise. It's like sometimes it's like you have to have a balance of both, or discipline. Like it's like you, I mean, I'm looking at you right now. I mean, people can't see you, but you've got these really fun earrings. And what are your earrings right now?
My
What are
earrings, so they're like little that's a brand called Brown Girls, and they're Filipino owned, and these are like little roasted pig lechons with like a little Filipino San Miguel beer.
I love it. That's so
I know I
cool.
tried, I was like, I'm seeing you, and I feel like, I mean, no one else is seeing us in theory, but like I still thought, I think especially with Zoom era,
Oh
pandemic era
yeah. I'm
fashion,
gonna
it's
pull
always
this
like
clip and put it on the internet so millions of people will see it. Hundreds of people will see it. Well, I was gonna say, I mean, but I always find it fascinating when like somebody is like, you know, kind of like cool looking and like fun, but they're also like very disciplined and like type A. Like I always think that's a really fun combination of sort of like, you know, it's like, oh, they just seem like they just like lay around all day and like, you know,
Oh.
read books and play the guitar or whatever. It's like, no, they are like out there working their ass off. You know, I don't know. I just
And
always
I feel
find
like
that
I try harder than I let on. And even when
fun.
it comes to like appearances and stuff, if I'm ever dressing up for something, it's just kind of fun to kind of like, I guess like ideate for a while or like ruminate on
Yeah.
something that you really want to do. And I guess like that's the thing is like it's sometimes like what happens in between is long, but like the actual process of it is short of the part of doing. And that's I guess like the similar thing with like Mayumu and making it. It was just like in my head for so long. And I think it's like years and years of work that I didn't even realize was work, because it's like every memory that you have or everything that you've ever eaten like leads up to this point in your palate and in your mind of what you like to eat and what you like to make. And so that's exactly how I feel about the book. It's just like so
Yeah.
weird to think about. It took 3 years in theory to from like I guess the proposal to being in print and being published. And it feels long, but actually that's really short in the grand scheme of like life.
And your book is like packed. Like your book is full of recipes. So it's not like, you know, you're skimping anywhere. It's like you really put so much time into it. Well, I was going to say one of the cool things about your book is that it's sort of autobiographical in terms of where you've lived. So maybe this is a good way to be the therapist, the lunch therapist, and have you like, you know, sort of that magical transitional moment in a movie where we flash back to your childhood. But can you tell us where you grew up?
Yeah, so I am originally from California. I was born in San Jose. My parents and my family, my immediate family, we moved to Stockton when I was six. So that's closer to Sacramento, Central Valley. And I went to UC Berkeley for my
Yes.
undergrad years.
Which is
And
its own
then,
chapter, right? I mean, that's like a
yeah,
separate chapter.
like it's such a pivotal part of my life. Like up to this point, it's weird to be so far out. Like literally, as of this year, it's like my 10-year in theory anniversary for high school, and I'm like, oh wow,
Wow.
like reunion
Oh,
era.
don't, well, that I'm like 25 years out, so I think you're doing
Know
fine. You're doing okay.
it's scary. I know it's like, oh, I was like, oh, the time really like creeps up, and it's weird to think that like there was a certain part of like, and I moved to New York right after graduating from Berkeley in 2017, and so it just feel weird to have like spent more time in New York City as like a full-fledged adult than I was like in college at UC Berkeley. So it is, yeah, I feel like I'm very grounded and like in New York makes me feel like a New Yorker. Even though I think people say that it's like 10 years in theory, but I
Oh,
feel
see, I grew up in New York on Long Island till I was 11, and then we moved to Florida when I was 11, and then I went back to New York for grad school, and I was there for like 6 years. But I don't think I've like as an adult done like the 10 years yet. And it's funny because we're moving back, as I mentioned to you, and it's like I want my like my New York City like stamp. Like I want to like be like a real New Yorker, but I want to do that at least the 10 years there now. So
Oh,
I
you're getting,
totally
I feel
get
like you can add from previous years too. I feel like
okay, all
that
right,
counts. I feel like
it's
you've already reached
cumulative. Yeah,
it
also like my mom is from Queens and my dad's from Brooklyn, and it's like I grew up with like a New York sensibility for
You're a
sure.
true New Yorker.
I
I
am a
still have
true New Yorker.
ways to
Yeah.
go.
But to rewind the tape a little bit, because we skipped ahead to college, but I want to hear a little bit more about your childhood in terms of the food that you grew up with and the cooking and the ingredients and flavors, like, and this is all in the book, but can you talk a little bit about like the cooking that went on when you were a kid?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it, my parents, they both worked, but it was kind of really cool to be in like a multi-generational household where I used to have like aunts, uncles living with us,
Really?
cousins,
And
my
where in
grandparents.
California was this again?
San Jose. So this is
San
South
Jose.
Bay.
Okay.
And I think it's really cool also to have like lived somewhere where it was such a big Filipino American like population and community that like I never felt like physically removed from that aspect of my life and culture, which is something that I think is like a privilege to say, because I know so many parts of like America can be predominantly white or
Yeah.
you feel very isolated. But physically I've always had Filipino people around me, and that and then by proxy that means like Filipino food as well. And so a lot of the food that I had growing up, my parents would, and I took it for granted, like adobo we talked about earlier. Like my parents, that was like their lazy, like I have to get this done really fast kind of meal. And I was always like, adobo again. And I feel like I'm really
You had no
ungrateful.
idea. Yeah,
I
and
had no
adobo, for those who've never had it, because I've made it before, but I mean, it's basically like meat braised in vinegar, right? I mean, it's like kind of like a vinegar sauce. It's so good. It's such a
It's so
good
good.
dish.
Soy,
Yeah.
vinegar, garlic. It's very like black pepper for sure. Like it's just such a good, well-rounded dish. But
And
I
is it
don't
usually
enjoy.
chicken or is it pork or is it both?
I think most commonly chicken, but like there's pork. People make tofu adobo now, like eggplant adobo. There's so many ways to prepare. I think it's mostly, I guess, like the style of just cooking something in vinegar, like you said, is pretty much adobo.
And what were the other dishes you grew up eating?
I grew up eating for special occasions. I'd always love getting like Filipino spaghetti. Even my dad would cook it, or Jollibee is very well known for like their Filipino spaghetti, but it's like banana ketchup, tomato sauce, and like Filipino hot dogs, which are like bright, bright red from like food coloring probably. But it's a very nostalgic thing where it's like I like sweeter, savory things. Interesting. So I guess that's some psychoanalyzing of like why I like more savory, sweet things.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But
So Filipino spaghetti was the sort of the gateway drug.
it's a great case study, I think, in like the ways that like I guess yeah, like ever since I was a kid, like I think that like my parents and then that too, that kind of recipe where it's very much like okay, Italian is very loose, but like I guess like very Italian American Filipino sensibilities coming together, and that was
What
just
is
like.
it? What is banana ketchup?
Oh my gosh, banana ketchup is so good. It's literally because you know how ketchup's usually made from tomato.
Yeah.
This was developed in like the Philippines to like address like like usage of like just native plants and ingredients. And so there's so many bananas, many banana trees. And I think that was like an element of using kind of local produce to be able to make something like this. And so it's really, really bright red as well. I think also for food coloring, but it comes in like just like these like bottles. And then a lot of times besides Filipino spaghetti, which it's commonly used for, it's like a nice like dipping sauce for like lumpia if you ever have that. And also like egg. There's like another Filipino breakfast dish called tortong tulong, which is basically like egg battered eggplant that's like splayed open-ish. And so it's like very like large in surface area and just like pan fried. And then like that is a really good side to have like banana ketchup with
So is
as well.
banana ketchup taste like bananas?
It does have like banana flavor, I think. And
Yeah, I'm
I
gonna
do
look
think
for it when
that
I get to New York. Yeah.
yes, I'll go to your apartment and we'll have some. I think it's
You
worth
are
trying.
invited. Yeah, come on over, bring the banana ketchup and we'll hang out and dip things in it.
Yes.
Okay, so you grew up in this and now did you so you grew up in a mostly Filipino community. Did that apply to school too? Like when you went to school, like was it mostly Filipino classmates and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, even when I moved to Stockton, I think that we have like a little Manila in Stockton as well, and it's very much like a lot of my friends are, it's funny because I feel like my parents also run in circles where it's like their kids are my friends or like and or my friends' parents become their friends. It's yeah, so it's a lot of symbiosis there of just like having a lot of Filipino friends in general and like also big families. And so I've always kind of had like a lot of cousins and a lot of I think that has helped me a lot too, just like like a lot of friendships, I guess, like even though you're sometimes it's like even if you're related by blood, it sometimes like doesn't really translate into true like I will text you out of the blue, not out of obligation. And I do have like really my one of my best friends is like my cousin Anna, who I did a recipe like also inspired by her is like food for the gods banana bread because we
I
call
saw
her
that. That looked really
Anna.
good. Yeah, it has sour cream and dates and oh, I love a
Yes.
good banana bread. It's so funny. This is a sidebar, but I just saw the musical that's on Broadway when I was there, Here Lies Love, which is
Oh, yeah.
about Imelda Marcos and it's all about the Philippines. It was really kind of fascinating. There's a lot I didn't know. I mean, did your parents were they born in America or did they come from the Philippines?
They were actually born in the Philippines, and so they only like immigrated to America in like the early 90s, and so it is, yeah, it is very interesting to in the same vein of like talking to other people who are Filipino American in our own communities. It's like it's very different if your parents have like moved when they were like full-fledged adults versus when they grew up here mostly in America. I think my parents are very old school in that like they were always like really stressed if I was or worried about me if I was like okay very in a way like strict parents and all that stuff in like parenthesis and like quotation marks. But I understand for like you know, in getting older, it's like, okay, I understand why. Okay, I couldn't go to a lot of like sleepovers or anything. My parents were very like stressed about so many things. But like, even in high school, I went to Yogurtland once and I forgot my phone in the car. And then they called every single parent that knew where to find me. And so I
No.
understand. I think it's a very suburban, very interesting mindset where, you know, moving to New York is like a lot more freedom that I see, like independence and
Yeah.
even that are growing up here. So it's like, wow, like, you know, I see, I wish that, but you know, I think it's always the grass is always greener on the other side kind of
How
thing.
did they because of your book, I'm just thinking about like the Filipino American like nexus in terms of food. How
Yeah.
did your parents adapt to like American cuisine? Like, did they immediately like it, or were they mostly cooking for themselves?
Oh yeah, I think that a lot of the times my parents would like they usually someone is usually cooking or they like really gravitate towards Filipino food. But like for some reason I think that like I don't know, I mean, this is a theory that I'm postulating, but like they love like you know El Pollo Loco. Do
I
you
live
know?
across the street from one, and I've never been, and I better go soon because we're leaving on Friday.
Oh
So
yeah, no, there's no El Pollo Locos here in New York that I've seen, but we love
okay.
like that and like Nando's, like if we take them to somewhere where there's like roasted chicken, they will really love like certain things. I think there's certain things that have crossed over that like they enjoy without like it having to be Filipino or anything. But it is fascinating, like, okay, like what is the overlap here? Why do you like these chicken places? But yeah, it's very much like I think that their perception and sometimes of like going to like other kids' birthday parties and stuff, they're always like they're always not judgy, but they're always like, wow, lots of pizza once again.
Yes, right. Well, you wrote in your book that, and then actually the name of the book means sweet, right?
Yes.
And Mayumu, is that how you say it?
Yes, correct.
And that your mom though found American desserts too sweet. So
Yes.
I thought that was kind of, it's on a psychological level. I don't know if we're getting all Freudian now, but I did think it was an interesting thing that like your mom found the desserts too sweet and you named your cookbook Sweet. So
Yes.
was it sort of an acknowledgement of, I mean, even when you talked about your lunch that you wanted something sweet after you had your tacos. So I mean, it feels like sweetness is sort of a theme in your life and your relationship with your mother and your career. And so, can you talk a little bit about like your mom's relationship to American desserts and then the desserts that you make?
Oh my gosh, yeah, I know, I feel like we're getting so deep, but like it does feel
Yeah, that's what this
like my
podcast
mom.
does. That's what makes it so good.
No, I feel like a sense of like I'm wearing like a Frasier shirt. I'm like, this feels so Frasierian.
Frasierian, that's funny.
But you know, I do think that there's an element of where I also felt as a kid, maybe like rebelling a little bit against like what my mom would want for me. Especially like food-wise, I think my mom was very much like, I don't know what got to her. It feels like very Goop-like of her. I was like, what else got to her before even Goop could? But like she would always look at things like is she would look at like Capri Sun and be like, what's in the package? Or like what's the ingredient list? And I was like, wait, but I really, really like Capri Sun. And like, can we please have this Capri Sun? And so like there are certain things I just remember begging for, like, especially like those you know, the 2 bite vanilla cupcakes that you see in the stores. Like my dad would let me get them. My mom would not. And so I usually like would game the system and be like, my mom is stricter here. She is the authority, but my dad will bend
This
to
is
my
such a
will.
com this is a common theme on this podcast. I just had Susan Spungen, the cookbook author, on, and she had a her mom ran a health food store and wouldn't let her have Lucky Charms, and all she wanted was Lucky Charms. And I didn't really have that issue. I had the opposite problem where my parents would only like buy me junk food. They'd get me like
Oh
Entenmann's and Twinkies and Ring-Dings. And I mean, when you were talking about Capri Sun, I would go to school every day with a giant Arizona iced tea. Do you remember those? They were
I
like,
love Arizona iced
yeah,
tea
but it's like
to this day.
literally drinking. You may as well like stick sugar in your veins. I mean, it is so sugary. So I
Yeah.
don't know what that says about our childhoods that we both became food writers. Mine, but I guess we were both correcting for somewhere like,
Course correcting somewhere,
yeah,
yes,
course
for
correcting.
sure.
So, well, that's also fascinating. So when you got to Berkeley, was that a culture shock to be away from your family? Or was it sort of just a natural segue?
Yeah, it's interesting. Berkeley, in theory, is like only an hour and a half drive from Stockton, honestly, and very close to like the South Bay. And so I think it was more so just it was hard to kind of really understand what it meant to like go to a predominantly white institution, kind of like Berkeley. A lot of like higher ed too is kind of like that. And that was something I hadn't experienced before. And it was something that, yeah, the privilege that I had of like always being in like the same circles, the same silos. I think that like Berkeley is really, you know, fascinating because it's like literally like in my business class when we're going to class and like on the banner in front of like the little entrance of the hallways, there's like, oh, congratulations to our Haas business student who just won a gold medal in Rio at the Olympics. And I'm just like, I think there's like a lot of like imposter syndrome of just like, okay, we get it. Even like watching Oppenheimer, like seeing like the Berkeley like scenes, and like he was there, physicist.
Oh, I haven't seen it yet, but
oh yes,
so
no
cool.
Spoilers, but yes.
I did see Barbie. I saw Barbie, so if you want to talk about Barbie, we could talk all about it.
Oh, I have to watch Barbie. I'm watching Barbie tomorrow, so I feel like we switched off in our knowledge.
Yeah,
but
totally.
Yeah, it was like a lot of elements of like, okay, I need a sense of like belonging somewhere, and I think that was like where I went into a lot of like Filipino student orgs, and I think that really helped me feel more at place, and also just like very empowering to be in like communities where you're building something together, mm-hmm. even against like all odds of like, honestly, mm-hmm. like there's so many things that it was, yeah, hard to succeed, but I think, yeah, it's like the people that you find really makes your undergraduate college experience better no matter where you go, and I think it's a privilege to have gone to Berkeley and stuff, but it is, yeah, I definitely talk about that a little bit in the book, just how that like, and I resorted a lot to like going out to eat in Berkeley, even though I did not have the budget for that, to be honest. But there's so much good food in Berkeley. It's very much like
we just went there. We did a road trip, like a farewell to California road trip. So we drove up to Sonoma, but we went through Berkeley and visited a friend, and I walked the campus and it was gorgeous. It was actually, what's the pot day? I should know this, the numbers. I mean, like smoking pot, like 415, 420, 420. God, that was so embarrassing. 420. So it was April 20th and we were there. So everyone was like, you know, doing some
on
kind
the glade.
Of, yeah, doing all that. But yeah, we went to Chez Panisse, yes. Which was really nice. But we also went to like some local. We went to the cheese board.
Yes, cheese board, amazing.
And we had. Well, I was going to ask you about Filipino food in America, because it's like, I feel like living in LA in the past couple of years, or maybe in the past 10 years, there's been like a resurgence, or maybe it's not even a resurgence necessarily. It's sort of like a new wave of interest in Filipino food. And there was a restaurant that opened and sadly closed during the pandemic called Mamsur, which was great. But there's also this one called La Cita. And there's just sort of these restaurants opening up. And I'm curious, like, what is your perspective on the American relationship to Filipino food, and do you notice a trend of it people being more interested in it now?
Yeah, I mean, I was just in LA recently too, and I went to La Cita, luckily,
yeah,
and it was amazing, great, yeah, and incredible. Kind of, you know, like even no matter the sizes of places, and I think La Cita is kind of smaller too, but like there's definitely like a proliferation of Filipino American restaurants that are really thriving across like the US, and it makes me really happy because I think there is like an element of, you know, these places, they, you know, it depends too on like where you are, like if it's like, you know, a mom and pop style place where it's like less, you know, frills but still delicious food, and mm-hmm. also on the other end there's, you know, like Kasama just won, I think, a huge like James Beard thing, like and they're in
where's
Chicago.
That Kasama,
it's in Chicago, and it was like mentioned, name dropped heavily in the bear. They went to Kasama in
oh
episode.
yeah.
So just yeah, Filipino food is definitely in the spotlight, and I think it's the important thing to also realize is that the pandemic has reshaped a lot of like the landscape of Filipino food, all food honestly, but in terms of like restaurant spaces, I realize that a lot of places that I'm really excited to see, or sometimes not even just places, just like chefs doing pop-ups, and they mm-hmm. don't necessarily have like the brick and mortar spaces to do these things, but it's like at some point sometimes that like escalates, and then they do end up getting a brick and mortar place because of the success that they've had with pop-ups. And in a similar way, like I did pop-ups, I did like treat box pickups in the park, and that has led me to do a cookbook. And so there's so many ways that like food, or like people's relationship with like, okay, this is like could be an amazing food place, but this is also an amazing food person at the end of the day who is making this food. And so I think people are hopefully like appreciating that more versus just like the real estate of like what food, where the food is being sold. And you know, so I think it's an interesting relationship that I think everyone is, as a consumer but also as like a maker, that we are all just kind of like, you know, we're understanding more that it takes so much to get to a certain point, or to even like give your food to other people, I think is like very, very scary and like really stressful.
Totally. Yeah.
And so it's a vulnerability thing that I think people are understanding. It's like a vulnerable one industry, and two, just like a vulnerable act of sharing, which is really mm-hmm.
Well, it's also like a novelty for a lot of people. I mean, it feels like America's had these waves of interest in Chinese food for a period. And then there was sushi. I mean, it was like huge in the 80s and 90s. And now it's like when I went to the Filipino restaurants in LA that I went to for the first time, I was eating dishes that I'd never had before. So there was also that sense of like, oh, this is like a whole new frontier to explore. And I think I think that's sort of part of the spirit of like, you know, dining now in America in 2023 is it's sort of like we want to experience more cultures. We want to break free of like, sort of, I mean, I think like the menu is a good, and I had a guest on this podcast, Jeff Gordonier, who wrote a book about Rene Redzepi at NoMA, and sort of was saying that he feels like fine dining in that era is over in a way, and that the menu marked the end of it. And it feels like the new interest is sort of in those mom and pops kind of places and more heartfelt, you know, for lack of a better word, authentic cuisine. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I went to the Filipino restaurant in LA, I had a dish called sisig. Do you know what I'm talking about? What is that? I'm trying to remember what it was.
Yeah, no, it's so funny because you mentioned that it's like a specifically Kampongan dish. So my family's from Pampanga and we're known for like very good home cooks and all that stuff. But it's basically kind of like it's usually like sizzling like on like a little platter or on a cast iron, but it's like a lot of the times it's pig parts, usually the face, usually like ears, snout. Pork belly sometimes people do is more indifferent, and I think that's more even more common because I don't think as many people use like all the pieces of
they
the pork
did belly. At this restaurant they did the pork belly, but then there was something else on there that was like from the
there's like usually
part of the
onion like pepper at least like sometimes like usually a fried egg or something, or you put an egg on top and then you mix it in. But it's it's such a delicious dish. I love that. I love getting seasick, and I think there's like so much of like there's a whole place or chain in the bay called Senior Sisig, and it's like combining sisig in like burritos and like different ways of like it's so amazing that I think sisig is like kind of this vehicle of like okay, similar to adobo, like people know what that is and now you know what sisig is, which is cool.
I didn't pronounce it right, but now I'm learning sisig. It sounds like seasick.
No, you're good.
But so are there Filipino restaurants in New York that you really like?
Ooh, you know, I think one of the places that I went to recently that I was like, oh wow, like to go back is there's this one place in Queens called Kabayan, and it's one of those places where you could do a Kamayan dinner where it's like the banana leaf situation, all the food is like set over on like the beautifully banana leaf lined tables and everything. So it is kind of a big party kind of situation, but the cool thing is that they have these bowls of soup called bulalo, and which is usually just like this big like bone marrow situation and like delicious broth just like set in the middle of like in different, so one time I went it was like 14 people or something, and so we each like had three sections where there was like a bowl, big bowl of soup for each part, like each group of people, and then they also just had like each, and this is like a very random thing to like really care about, but like there's like this really yummy like fried fish that they had, that like they had pieces for everybody. So like bungos is like a very common fish, this is what it's called, like marinated milkfish is what it is.
Okay.
And everyone loves it's like so good for like breakfast salogs, which are like rice and egg and whatever protein, and for that is like bungos salog is something you would say like a portmanteau. But it's so good, like they had, and like I just felt really full and happy eating that, and it feels very, I know, I feel like that was very specific, but I was like, this is an amazing experience to have. Like,
no, when you come over with the banana ketchup, we should go from there to Queens and then we'll eat all that food together. I wanted to ask you, I mentioned it in your book, and you're about the author, and you mentioned it just now, but during the pandemic, you cooked food, but you didn't mention this in the podcast, but you were raising money for COVID charities. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, like for when I first started my blog, The Dusky Kitchen, it was also in tandem with like making dessert boxes that I would, you know, like basically like put like pre-orders for and then donate all those proceeds to local mutual aid funds. And there's one called like Bed-Stuy Strong, which is like based in my neighborhood. And at the time it was like a lot of helping people in the community who couldn't even go like grocery shopping because they're like, you know, most vulnerable to COVID. And delivering groceries to like neighbors and stuff. And so like, I think that the work that I did, you know, throughout the early years of the pandemic, and even now sometimes I'll do like cake fundraiser raffles if there's like something that comes up, like You and Me bookstore in Chinatown, unfortunately, like experienced like fire damage and all this stuff. And so they've been closed, have to be closed for another year. So I did like a a fundraiser raffle to, like, if anyone donated to their GoFundMe, just let me know and I'll enter you in a raffle. I'll make you a custom cake. And like, there's certain ways that I feel like baking and desserts, like, I'm so glad it's like given me like a purpose to kind of
Yeah.
do that. And like, because I think like I did the blog, I started a blog before thinking like of any of that. And it was like a thing, like, I've always wanted to do a food blog, always want to do a food blog. But I think it was really the incentive of like, okay, like, and if I can actually help people. And I think the tangibleness of like having physical desserts again changes things, because I do have like so many things that I made, like for a blog too, you can always like make other people's recipes and stuff, and like you
Right.
just document your journey making that. But it's totally different when you get to see people's reactions to what you're making, and also like them actually, you know, there's like a clear response, where I think that sometimes, like, even though someone's like, oh, I love that recipe on the internet, it doesn't always like translate to like, oh, I made the recipe, or hopefully they did. But like, you know, like, I think it's so different when people can actually put a name and face to what they're trying.
Yeah. So you got to meet people while you were doing this, but I mean, this is a nosy question, but was it expensive to give all this food away
You
and
know,
make it all? Yeah, it
it
sounds like it
was.
would be crazy.
It
Yeah, that's a
is so
lot of
expensive.
money. Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it was things where it's like, so in full transparency, I also work full time in like the music industry.
Oh,
I
see,
do.
that's what I was gonna ask you, because you were working, and I was like, but she's a food writer, so like, what's she doing at this apartment? But so you're working another job that's not
I'm
food
working a
related.
whole other job. And yeah, it's
Got
very weird
it.
to
Okay.
be in like two different industries in theory. Like, I am a cookbook
Yeah.
author and a food writer. Also, like, I do email marketing for, you know, live music. And it is, yeah, it's a lot of juggling. And I think that's the reason why I'm able to do those
Yeah.
kinds of fundraisers and do those kinds of like
Because in
pop-up.
case people don't realize it, I mean, this is so funny, because I've been doing this for 20 years, and it's funny, because you'll read people be like, oh, you can make a career as a food writer, or like, you can support yourself. And it's like, not really. I mean, maybe like a handful of people can fully support themselves as a food writer, but it's hard. It's like, you don't get paid even that much to do a cookbook. I mean, I'm not going to ask you how much you got paid for your cookbook. I made that mistake actually once when I did my cookbook. The New York Times was doing this like article about food bloggers back in 2006, and they said, how much did you get paid for your cookbook? And I was like, oh, I got paid XYZ. And then the second it left my mouth, I was like, oh my God, I don't want that published in the newspaper. But then
Oh
they included it in the article. Anyway, my point is that it's hard to make it as a food writer exclusively. So it makes a lot of sense that you have another job.
yeah, it does like pay for flour and a lot of things that
Yeah.
I think people don't realize is like food writing and recipe development. Like, you're making recipes multiple times. You're
Yeah.
also like, the time that is spent is kind of just like not even labor. You're just thinking about ingredients. And now with inflation, everything is so
Yeah.
expensive. So
My thing is like, if I taught a class on food writing, I'd be like, here's the best way to make it as a food writer is to marry well.
honestly, I'm not even joking, but like for health insurance purposes and like,
Yes, yeah.
that's like the saddest thing, is to realize that people, a lot of times, especially in New York, I feel like, and probably LA too, it's just like someone has to be like the square 9 to 5 person.
Yeah.
The other person has to subsubsidize the other
Yeah,
person.
and I earn my keep. I mean, look, I keep everyone very well fed,
Of
and I mean, it
course.
always smells good in here. Things are baking. There's a cake on the cake stand all the time. So, I'm doing my part, but yeah, it's very hard to sustain. So okay, so during the pandemic, you did all that, and then now that you're on the other side of all that, do you have interest in like a brick and mortar, like selling your food somewhere, or do you mostly want to keep writing cookbooks and do all that?
I think that I never say never to like a brick and mortar, and it's just not in the immediate plans. But it's funny to like be like, you know, like to people who want to try something that I made. It's like, well, I made all 75 recipes for you to try now. So
Yeah,
it's
got
like
it.
you're in different places at once, which is really cool to be like, okay, like I can't do this for you by myself, but this is my words and these are what I intend, and like hopefully you can translate to what you want to make too. So I'm never opposed to like hopefully one day having a bakery, but immediately, like, I love still recipe developing and like writing, and I still do that with whatever capacity I can with working also full time. But it is tough to kind of see, I guess, like the what's it called when you can't see what's called, close. Okay, I'm
Or the
always
forest for the trees?
the yes, something like that, where it's like,
Yeah.
okay, like, because you're in the weeds for so long, like when you're writing code, and you probably really understand this too, is just like, you know, it's like you work on this for 3 years and you're like, okay, and then what now is what everyone wants to know.
I know.
And
That's a
you're like,
hard feeling. Yeah.
yeah, like I've had tunnel vision on this like one thing, And that's what I had to take some time to kind of like, even now that I'm like making some new recipes or something for something else, or just like a magazine or whatever, I still feel like there's a certain, not block, but like, oh my God, like it's like a void of so much of like your creative output just came out of you. And
Yeah.
it's like, where are my new ideas and what can I do? This is my identity, is like this book. And it's like, and I still like, I'm very grateful that I get to like talk about the book and like how much it like changed my life. But it's still in weird ways, like it's still, you know, I don't think it ever leaves you, like that you wrote a book and it's like that weight of that is kind of huge. And I think that's so hard to bounce back to like day to day, like, or big term, long term goals, because it's like, whoa, like I had one big one and now what do I do?
Well, it's
So.
funny because as your lunch therapist, I'm not supposed to tell you what to do. I'm supposed to just listen to you and like let you resolve your own issues. But as we're talking, I'm like, wait a second. Like you've done baking for people before. You did it for charity. You like the experience of giving people this food and seeing their reaction. And I'm thinking you have a great brand because you have the name of the book and that could be the name of the bakery. And you have these really unique dishes like or like baked goods that nobody else would be selling. I mean, who else would be selling an adobo chocolate chip cookie in New York? So I kind of think that's where you're headed secretly. And I'm also hoping that's where you're headed because I'm moving to New York and I'll come there all the time and patronize your bakery. Well, so now you are at your boyfriend's apartment, you mentioned earlier. So do you guys cook a lot together or do you cook for him or does he cook for you or how does that all work?
Oh my gosh, it's so funny because there are a lot of tweets that are like, okay, like a lot of people like, you know, it's like romantic to like cook together, but really I'm very stressed.
I hate cooking. I never cook with my partner. I've been with him for 17 years and he's
Oh.
not allowed in the kitchen. He's never
No.
allowed. Yeah.
And I think if even if it were like, and we do end up having to like, you know, do some work together at the same time, but it's always kind of like someone has to be like lead and the other person has to be the sous.
Yeah.
And like head chef and sous chef really makes sense, even like a two-person kitchen, because it's like, I think it's like even one bigger brain than the other is just like too many cooks in the kitchen, where it's like,
Yes.
we get it that this is your dish, so I will execute. And even then, it's like not even sometimes like the food part of it, the food prep part, it's like cleaning and like dishes and stuff. I think about that so much, where my boyfriend is really good about like washing all the dishes while I like haphazardly like put a lot of like, and baking, there's so many dishes. I don't even know. It's like you're just knee deep in dishes. So yeah, I really appreciate him for at least when I care a lot about something like that, he will, you know, step up and maybe step back and be like, okay, it's okay that I'm not the lead person on this point
See,
project or
Craig
whatever.
is really bad at doing the dishes, or I'll put it this way, like he doesn't scrub the dishes before he puts them in the dishwasher because he believes in the power of the dishwasher, but I don't believe in the power of the dishwasher. And so over the years, I think it was a very masterful plan on his part because now I do all the cooking and I do all the dishes because I don't like how he does the dishes. So now I do it all, but I'm a one-man
I
operation.
understand. I totally understand that. But you know,
Yeah.
sometimes letting go. Maybe I am the therapist now, the lunch therapist.
Oh yeah, turn the tables.
It's
Wait,
okay.
so how long have you guys been together?
We've been together for 5 years now.
Oh, nice. And how
So
did
it's
you meet? Not to be your Jewish mother, but I'm gonna
food
your little
related.
Yenta. Yeah.
It's Coffee Meets Bagel was the app that we met on.
That sounds
Which
familiar. What was that?
it's such it feels like such a different time, but it was like it's similar to those dating apps where you only get like a couple choices or a few choices a
Yes,
day. So it's
love that.
very, it's not like Hinge or Tinder where you get like unlimited swipes or anything.
Right.
But it was always kind of weird because it's like, who is the coffee and then who is the bagel? Or how
What
are
is
we
it? What does it
determining?
mean?
I don't know. But it was also, I felt kind of weird sometimes because like I remember back in way back when I was single, it was like you would pay for, okay, this sounds bad, but it's like you would earn beans. And then you'd pay for more options. Like, I was like, sounds, I was like, why are you
Wait,
buying?
this was on Shark Tank. I saw them pitch this app on Shark Tank
Yes, there
and
are many success stories, right? I feel like we are one,
yeah.
but it
I love Shark
is so
Tank, so yeah, I
interesting.
remember that one. Well, it worked. Clearly, it worked for you guys. So, where did you
Oh
guys meet? Like, where's your first date?
my God, our first date was at the Alamo Draft House in downtown
Nice.
Brooklyn,
We
and we
were
watched
just there.
Phantom.
We saw Phantom Thread. Phantom Thread's
Yes.
a funny movie to see on your first date because it's kind of twisted in terms
It
of what
is.
happens in that story.
A weird romance, but
And
like,
cooking, like, is like all this like poisoning that happens. Do you remember how it ended?
yes, I know it's kind of weird, but that's why we're like, okay, we had to like talk more about it, and we went to like another bar to like discuss and everything. But yeah, it's weird to, and I was just talking to my boyfriend too when we were in DC. I was in DC last weekend, and we're just spitballing, like, oh, what should we make that's like Filipino? And he's from Pennsylvania, he's from outside of Philly.
Okay.
And so, like, what are some like fun, like Philly, Filipino fusion things that we could make? And it's just like really cool to, like, I guess he's so ingrained in my life and subconscious,
Yeah.
like those kinds of things, like food, and it's like
Wait, I have an idea for you. Filipino cheesesteak. Like
love it.
Philippino. I mean, you're gonna sell this at your bakery. I mean, this is like
I
it's writing
see.
itself. It's
I
all
have a
happening.
business plan already from you. So I mean, it's like those kinds of things where it's like, I do think that, like, the people that you meet and like the people in your lives, like, it's just so, it's dynamic where it's like your identity is not stagnant. Like, I'm Filipino American, but like he's also American in a different way where he grew up in
Yeah.
Philly. So I have all this like influence and ideas into my own head now. So, and not to say like you're claiming it as your own, but you're just incorporating it in ways that, like, okay, this is making something completely different and new, but from something familiar. And I think that's like the ethos of the book and ethos of like my style of cooking and baking as well.
Yeah, I forgot to ask you when you were at Berkeley, what was your like, what did you study there?
I studied business and media studies. And so
Oh
I
my
did.
God. So you have a business background too? Oh my God. I mean, this
I
is
know. I
like,
feel like the entrepreneurship really is a lot when you're a food writer. So I feel like that has helped me a lot in that sense.
yeah.
But yeah, like otherwise, it's very funny because I think that a business program specifically makes you want to be like an accountant, a consultant, or a banker. And I did not become any of those things,
Right. Well, it's
unfortunately.
funny because I have friends that are in LA and they don't understand like why I don't want to open a restaurant or like you love to cook, like why don't you open up? And it's like because that's a nightmare, like having to do that. Like, I mean, you've watched The Bear. It's like it's so much work and it's so thankless and you don't make that much money and it's nonstop and you have cranky customers and you get bad Yelp reviews and meanwhile, like I also love writing. I mean, I don't know if you feel that way, but like writing is like that's my passion. I mean, like I love cooking and I love writing. So it's like to strip one of those away would like ruin it for me in a way. But it sounds like you equally enjoy both aspects of it.
It's true, but I do feel like the same way with you, at least with writing specifically, where it's something where it's like an outlet, one, but two, like it's really nice to, I guess, like see your thoughts somewhere where it's like, I'm always like doing hand movements that you can't
Oh
see what I'm
yeah,
but
she's
like,
doing lots of hand movements. Yeah.
yeah, like these are, fully formed fledged thoughts that I think that writing was always kind of like, in a way that we're talking about therapy, it's like journaling and stuff, or even the act of like, this is what I ate today.
Yeah.
It's really nice to like look back on, and I take a lot of photos too, just because of like I have bad memory and I'm like, I need to remember this specific meal that I had and what I ate yesterday. And it is kind of helpful to be like, and in no other way than just like documenting like your life and your story. And I think even the small things are important, and I think that's like the thing that people don't always realize with like food writing. It's like some people trivialize it a lot because it's,
Yeah.
fun and food and whatever, but it's like there's so much that goes into it, and so much like research, and so much of like people's passions go into food and whatever aspect of food journalism that someone is in, whether it's like, even if you're making a listicle of like 10 best restaurants to
Yeah.
check out, like it's not insignificant, it's still important and people still read
Oh,
that.
yeah, and it impacts people's lives. I mean, people will make this food for their families and they will bring their families to restaurants that you write about. So it's like this is I actually find food writing unique in that it's like any other form of writing, like you can't taste the thing that like the person is writing about. But with food writing, it's like, you can go into your kitchen and make that thing and experience it viscerally. So I really like it. What was I going to ask you? I was going to ask you why you named your blog The Dusky Kitchen.
I named it the Dusky Kitchen because it was the time of day of dusk when I could go home from work. So I'd commute from Manhattan into Brooklyn. And then by the time I got into my kitchen, it was dusk. And then also, like, our lighting is really bad in our kitchen. There's like one window, it's very, very bad. So I would just try to like turn it into a positive thing with like Dusky Kitchen. And it's very funny. I always have to correct people, that's not Dusty Kitchen. Well, Dusty can't. I was like, I hope it's not
Yeah,
a Dusty Kitchen. I do commute
the,
quite often.
right. Dusky is different than dusty. Yeah, a
Yes,
dusty
totally
kitchen is
different.
not appealing. Yeah, you don't want dusting your
No.
food. When did you start it?
I started in the summer of 2020, so the same time as I was doing treat boxes. And yeah, I'm very grateful because without it, I would not have a cookbook, honestly.
Do you know when I started my food blog? I bet
When?
you weren't like even born yet. 2004.
don't worry, I am 28, so I
okay.
I'm still
right. But that's not that much. I mean, my blog is almost like what, 20 years old? Yeah, like 19 years old. So yeah, that 2020 is insane to me. That's like literally like yesterday you started your blog.
I always have to say this from like one blogger to another. Like I'm like in awe that you've had been blogging for the last 20 years, because it's the first of all, logistically, the upkeep of the domain and like hosting is so expensive. People do not talk about that enough.
That's another thing. It's like, I'm really good at spending a lot of money as a food writer to make very little money. That's my economic model.
But it's just like something where it's like, yeah, you buy in and they give you like a deal for the first 3 years that you do. And then like, you have to just stay on this treadmill because like someone will sweep up your domain and like hold it for ransom or something, which is so awful. But yeah, power to you, because it's such a different model now with like Substack that people are like kind of turning.
Well, I switched to Substack to make more money, because you can have subscribers. But I went through a period not too long ago where I revived the food blog and I started writing on it again, because I like that people could discover it through SEO, that like somebody could Google a recipe and then just sort of fall into this world. But it's so much harder to break through now. I mean, like when I was doing my food blog, I had a post called "The Best Broccoli of Your Life," where I roasted broccoli. It was sort of the beginning of that period where people were roasting vegetables, and it went viral at that time. It was like 2011, 2012, and it got to the point where if you Googled broccoli recipe, I was the number one broccoli recipe on the internet. And now, like, for that to happen again, you would have to like hire a team of like, you know, engineers to create the right SEO to work on Google. You know, it's like I can't even begin to think about how that all works. So,
Oh my God. But yeah, you're a pioneer, honestly. A whole different feel. It was like such a different landscape.
And I feel like I'm like an old grandpa. If it were, when back in my day, we had to do our own SEO.
Get you back to bed, grandma.
Well, anyway, well, every podcast begins with "What did you have for lunch?" But it ends with "What are you having for dinner tonight?"
Ooh, so I am not cooking tonight, unfortunately, but I am going to a bar to meet up with a friend and my boyfriend called Roses R&R. Bar in somewhere in, I guess, like here in North Brooklyn. But they do have like spam musubi, and they do have like dumplings and like crab rangoon that I'm really excited about.
Really? That sounds good.
I will probably be having that for dinner.
So it's a bar, but they serve food. So it's kind of a restaurant too, but feels more like a bar.
What would you call? I do feel like bars lately, they have like, okay, some different from bar to bar, but I think also pandemic wise things have changed. Remember when they had to serve food with like a drink, so they gave you like a bag of chips or like,
oh really? I didn't know that. I wasn't in New York for that.
Oh yeah, New York. Oh yeah, it was so weird because they'd be like, oh yeah, like here's like a grilled cheese, and it was like Kraft singles, like on like Sara Lee situation. It was like bare minimum what could food even be.
Oh, but because they couldn't serve alcohol unless they serve food after the pandemic. Oh, that's fascinating.
So I think there's more food lately at bars than I've realized, but it feels like more they like, you know, more specialization into this type of food that hopefully at this bar. I've never been to this bar, so I'm kind of excited.
And it's in Greenpoint, the bar?
I think it's in, technically maybe Williamsburg, Greenpoint area up north.
That feels like the spot. Like, I feel like when we were looking for apartments, I was like, I'm not even cool enough to live in Greenpoint, but like, it's a cool neighborhood. And I love that bookstore, Archestratus. Have you been there yet?
Yeah,
it's amazing. It's like used cookbooks and they sell sandwiches and stuff. But I love a cookbook store like that. And I'm going to be there all the time, I think.
Oh my God, yes. Come over to Greenpoint. And yeah, I feel like Greenpoint has also changed a lot. I mean, it's so popping, but there, my boyfriend's area, he's kind of in the Polish neighborhood part of Greenpoint. So there's a lot of great little grocery stores and all that stuff. And you can get pierogies like at every single grocery store, which is really nice.
Yeah. And you get sausages all over, right? Like Polish sausages.
Yeah. So it's interesting. Yeah. When you're here, you'll see a New York that I feel like you've lived here, but it's changing all the time, which, you know, for better or for worse, but exciting at the same time.
I'm really excited. Well, I'm so excited for our banana ketchup Queen's date. And congratulations on your book. I mean, it is truly an accomplishment. It's a great book. And if you're listening to this, everybody should go out and buy it. she's holding it up. You guys can't see it, but it has Baked Alaska on the cover. All right. Well, have a great rest of your day. Abby, thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Adam. Take care. Good luck on your move.
Oh, thanks. I'll see you soon. Bye.